The following audio program is suitable for all ages. It's October 9th, 2005, and you're tuned in to the RetroBits podcast. Hi, I'm Earl Evans, your host, and this is a show where we talk about computing like we did it back in the day. That's right, here we're all about old-school computing and modern-day fun. If it's got 8 bits, paper tape, punch cards, CPM, cartridge slots, BASIC and ROM, or if it's just plain old, then you've found the right podcast. This is show number 15, and today's topic, the bulletin board system, part 2. If you're a first-time listener, or if you've been with us for a while, either way, welcome aboard. You can get information about the show, including all the links that I talk about during the podcast, at our podcast hosting site. And that URL is RetroBits, RetroBits, libsyn.com. And if you'd like to send in email, you can use the address RetroBits@gmail.com. So hey, how's everybody doing? I'm kind of upbeat tonight. Tomorrow's a holiday, and so I don't have to get up early. It's kind of cool. And also, my birthday's coming up here in a couple weeks, and I'm wondering what kind of retro stuff I should put on my birthday list. I guess if I want anything that takes any time to get, then I better move quick, huh? Like I say, tomorrow's a holiday, but it's not a holiday for my kids. It turns out that they're going to school, so my wife and I might go see a movie. We're thinking about going to see Serenity, that new sci-fi that's out in the theaters. So that should be fun and relaxing. Get to spend a little bit of time with Jill. So I was checking the stats for the show and getting kind of pumped up about that. The average audience over the last 3 shows was 186 people. Woohoo! And the downloads have hit 2,500 if you count all of the shows in total. And so I was looking at that and thinking, you know, this is cool. I'm really glad that people are enjoying it. Those kind of numbers do stress me out just a little bit, gotta admit. But this continues to be super fun stuff. So thanks for listening, and I appreciate it. I'll do the best I can to put on a good show here. By way of retro stuff this week, I went ahead and spent the $50 for some software called Atari Peripheral Emulator. It's software that you can get from Atari Max, and it runs on your PC. And if you connect your Atari to the PC with an SIO to PC connector card, then your PC can emulate all kinds of things. It can emulate a disk drive, printers, modem. I've talked about it on the show before. I went ahead and got the registered version. The CD shipped super fast. I've already got it. It's got the program, the version that doesn't require you to go through the unregistered delay screen. And it also has 600 megabytes worth of great archive stuff. So I'm pretty excited to look through all that. But I mean, 600 megabytes worth of Atari stuff, you got to admit, that's going to take me a while to look through. Also, I was going through one of the books on, I believe it's the AtariArchives.org site. There's a book up there on how to do player missile graphics. And player missile graphics was a type of graphics on the Atari that allowed images to float on top of the virtual canvas of the screen and move around independently, kind of the sprite concept. And in this particular book, they talk about how to use character string arrays as your memory space to store the graphics info for these player missile graphics. And I've been poking around with that, trying to learn it. You've got to line up your character string arrays on a 1024 byte boundary, if I remember right. So you have to do some mathematical tricks to make sure that your stuff starts in the right spot. But anyway, I'm picking that up and having some fun. Who knows? Maybe I'll crank out a game for the Atari. It's tough for any one computer to keep my attention long enough for me to actually really get in deep on it. But, you know, one of these days I ought to pick a model and stick with it for a little while so that I can actually do something on it. By way of emails, Mike wrote in. He said he had a hectic week. He liked the episode that I did on Quantum Link. And I was thinking, Mike, I think you'd mentioned Skype one time in one of your emails. Maybe you and I should try Skype at some point. I could pick your brain on that ham radio BBS stuff. Turns out both Mike and I have used the ham radio, the radio equivalent of a modem called packet radio. And when I was on there, I would use things called digital repeaters or digipeaters so that I could have contact with somebody else over several hops, kind of like router hops on the internet, except this is over radio. And I used a frequency band called 2 meters. But I didn't use packet radio BBSs, but those things were out there. Mike used them, and I guess he has some information on that. So I'd like to hear about it. Probably the listeners of the show would like to hear about it, too. It's another adjunct to the BBS world. Philip wrote, and he gave me some audio feedback as well as some email. I'm going to play that audio for you right now. It's pretty interesting. I've never actually had feedback on the podcast in audio form before, excluding, of course, the nice piece that I was able to play last week from Dave Ross with the recap on the Commodore Expo. But anyway, here's Philip's audio clip that he sent in.
Hi, Earl. This is some feedback for you from the UK. My name's Philip Eaton. I live in London in the UK. And just like to say that I really enjoy your show. It's nice and relaxing, and I listen to it on my MP3 player on the way to work. Just wondering if you might consider doing some sort of broadcast regarding the computers that came from the UK, the Clive Sinclair thing, which I think you've mentioned once or twice in your podcast. One computer that's of real interest to me is something called the Jupiter Ace, which was it was made by a couple of the people that used to work for Sinclair Computers, as you may know, and some of its peripherals are actually compatible with the ZX81, I believe, or maybe it's a Spectrum, one of the two. But yeah, great computer that runs with an operating system language called Forth, which I spent many a happy year programming for commercially about 10 or 12 years ago, which was great fun. So yeah, if you've ever thought of doing a podcast on that, it'd be great to listen to. Okay, once again, thanks very much for the podcast. Very interesting, and it's great that someone spends the time doing this, and I'm glad you found a good hobby. Okay, bye now.
Well, thanks, Philip. Wasn't that cool? That was pretty neat. And I will spend some time covering those computers, Philip. As it turns out, I've had, like I've mentioned before, quite a bit of call to cover some of the systems that weren't necessarily popular or developed in North America. And we'll be spending some time researching that, and I'll also talk about that in an upcoming email here. Philip also mentioned in a subsequent email that he had recently attended the Classic Gaming Expo in the UK, and I'll have a link up for that in the show notes. I got to remember, because I don't think that's in the notes here, but going to try and remind myself. Anyway, apparently someone there had a Commodore 65. This is a really interesting machine. It's a prototype Commodore computer. It was like a super 8-bit. It was never actually manufactured for production, but a lot of prototype models of this exist and had leaked out, especially after the demise of Commodore. I'd love to have one, but obviously they're very expensive whenever somebody does decide to sell one. And I will have a link if you're interested in learning a little bit more about this computer, and also the tons of stuff that Commodore made in their R&D labs but never actually released to the public. I mean, it's so much stuff that there's actually an entire website about it called The Secret Weapons of Commodore. The link that I'll give you, you can go to the homepage for that particular site and check out all of that stuff. It's a lot of reading. John sent some email on a way to craft a homemade pop filter. Thanks, John. I'll definitely look into this. If nothing else, this could be an interim step until I could actually scrape up some pennies for the real thing. Also, Yanlin Thompson of the C64 Takeaway sent some email up, also linking me off to a site with information on building your own pop killer. And again, that's a device that you put in front of the microphone so that your p-p-p sounds are not so pronounced. Makes the audio a lot more enjoyable to listen to. So, armed with info from these folks, who knows, I might be able to craft myself up one of these things and save a few dollars. We'll see. But in any case, I'm going to try and get hold of that. Chris C. wrote me with some information on CompuServe, including some info on their pricing. This info was very entertaining. One of the things that it said on the info sheet is that your modem should be set for 110 through 300 baud. Woohoo! Whoa! Put on your seatbelts! But it turns out on the same sheet on the back, they did support 1200 baud, although you would have had to have quite a bit of money to pay for it. It was $17.50 in off hours per hour and $35 per connect hour in prime time. Ouch! And 300 baud even in prime time was $22.50. You know, I remember that actually. I had CompuServe for business purposes back in the day, early 80s when this was, and also later on had it from my own small business when I had my consulting company. And yeah, it was pricey. Hopefully your checkbook in those days was larger than your baud rate. And also, Chris mentions Bo Zimmerman's Great Commodore site. And I'll have a link for that up there. All kinds of great Commodore info, including a good Commodore file library. Thurston sent me some links to a video tour of the Computer History Museum in Silicon Valley. This is in the San Francisco Bay Area of California. Now, I've only had a chance, Thurston, to click on those links and watch a couple minutes. I haven't been able to see them all the way through, but I got to tell you, this is great. I haven't been to the Computer History Museum myself, and I'm wanting to go very badly. And this is going to give me a taste. So, cool. Now, it's on the Channel 9 site that Microsoft runs. From what I've observed, Channel 9 is a video blog and discussion forum, and it's primarily geared for developers that are using Microsoft development products. And so, I've been on that site before, personally being interested in Microsoft development. But never expected to see this. Anyway, there's two links on there, and I'll have them both up on the show notes. You can check those out. And finally, Chris O. writes, this is the first time that Chris has sent email. He has a nice retro computer collection. He's both a retro computing and a retro gaming fan. And one of the things that he does is interesting experiments in getting programs in their original form, say on tape or disc, and then attempting to reconstitute them and return them to that original form or something close to it. It sounded like some interesting stuff that you're doing there, Chris, and a good way of preserving some of this history. He also points out that, again, I said I'd be talking about this, a lot of the computer history that's out there in books and movies and that sort of thing miss many things that didn't happen in North America specifically. And again, I agree. And also, Chris, I'd like to take you up on your offer along with some of the other folks that have offered the same to help equip myself with some knowledge and some background in these computers so that we can expand the horizons of retrobits of the material that I cover to a worldwide scope, because I do have folks that listen to RetroBits from all over the world and would definitely like to cover some of those computers. So anyway, we'll be back in touch with you and with some of the other folks that have made the same offer, and we'll get that done. Chris also has a UK Gaming News podcast, and I will have the link for that podcast on the show notes. All in all, excellent emails. And really, the email section covered my news and links section for this week. And so, you know, just this week is a great collaborative effort, I think. And I thank those of you who send in material. Want to invite anyone with something to share to definitely send it in. Again, retrobits@gmail.com. And, you know, together we'll all share the wealth on this retro computing stuff. So, wow, I'm up to almost 15 minutes here and just getting to the main topic. This week is the Bulletin Board System Part 2. And just to let you know, I had hoped to have some interviews with some friends, and that hasn't panned out at this point. in part due to my own time constraints and inability to get in touch with them. So what I decided to do was take another pass through the various episodes of that BBS documentary that was produced by Jason Scott. Again, the URL for that, www.bbsdocumentary.com. And try to give you a taste of what information is in that BBS documentary. Now, it turns out they've recently lowered the price on this DVD box set, it looks like. The price was lowered to $40. And it's just an incredible deal if you see these videos, because the information in here, especially if you're at all interested in the history of BBSing, or if you were involved in BBSing yourself. Anyway, just fantastic. And again, licensed under the Creative Commons licensing. Jason is very interested in preserving BBS history, so he used that media license that encourages the very type of derivative production that I'm doing this week, taking some snippets and some information and putting it into my podcast. So thanks for that, Jason, and with no further ado, because we all hate ado, here we go. First off, I want to cover SysOps. This is one of the main episodes of the BBS documentary, and covers the mystique, or how would I say, the way that SysOps were perceived by the users of BBSs. Basically, in a lot of cases, SysOps were perceived in an almost godlike way, very cool. When they got together with users of their BBSs, SysOps were usually treated very well, like the red carpet treatment. And also, SysOps could be kind of intimidating when you were on a BBS and you were using it, and all of a sudden the SysOp would break in and you were in SysOp chat mode, and whoa, you know, this is really the person behind the keyboard. Wow, it's interesting. For a little bit of that flavor, let me play for you this first. I'm going to have actually five total audio clips today, and so here's the first one.
I guess the system operator, you know, came out of the mainframe, and the operators in a mainframe environment were people of humble stature but great power. And the same held true of people who operated BBSs. I mean, you could do whatever you wanted.
And I forget if it was because I was posting something or I was having trouble figuring my way around since it was my first time. But he broke into chat, which completely freaked me out, because I don't even think at that time I understood there was a system operator, an individual running it out of his house. And so this guy breaking into chat to basically berate me, like, what are you doing? How are you doing it? Who are you? What are you doing? What's your handle? And I was afraid that I was taking too long just reading what he wrote. It's very scary.
For the longest time, when I was using other people's BBSs, I would write everything very carefully, because I knew it was important not to say anything embarrassing and have to backspace it, because the SysOp would be watching.
You kind of get this idea of what a system operator is. You try to chat with them, and they're never there. They're like a cool person that's somewhere else. So I wanted to be a cool person.
The SysOp is the cool one that all the users want to get to know, and they want to be like.
SysOps were definitely treated quite well. There was a respect factor, and then there were people that we would have BBS events, and everyone would want to buy the system operator all the beverages they wanted.
Hey, you know, I actually know Jim. He's the SysOp of, you know, such and such BBS. You know, all of a sudden you sort of raised up in clout. You know, hey, I'm good friends with the SysOp.
People, like, users would look up to you, like you knew a lot.
I mean, there is some, like, you know, God aspects to it, because you can read all the private messages.
And it was like approaching Mecca the first time I saw where the bulletin board was actually running, you know, to actually log in at the console. I just thought that was the most amazing thing.
So I used a number of BBSs back in the BBS days, but I never actually ran a BBS. I was never a SysOp, and it sounds like by not doing that, I missed some of the royalty treatment. So, yeah, bummer. Well, maybe I'll do that in the retro way, you know, with these Telnet BBSs. In any event, a lot of BBSs were free. They were hobby services. People would run them out of the kindness of their heart, and because of the experience that they would gain and the fun that they'd have and that kind of thing. And there were also BBSs that emerged that you had to actually pay to be a member of. And as you can imagine, this was quite controversial, and it was controversial on both sides. I mean, there were two sides to this picture. This first clip that I'm going to play for you, is a clip of some folks who, it sounds like, don't necessarily agree with this concept of a pay BBS, or at least it's not something that they're personally interested in. Here's the clip.
When bulletin boards started to, in mass, charge for their services, the controversy was free or pay, free or pay. And the free guys, the hobbyists, were outraged, because the guys who got pay could afford better equipment. They could afford new phone lines. So these commercial BBSs started growing in power and in subscribership. And the hobbyist guys said, you know, this isn't fair. This was like ham radio. We were supposed to be all just friends here. And you guys are breaking the silent pact that we had with the group.
That's where you lost the hobbyist aspect. That's where you lost that heart that I felt was there. I did it. I ran a bulletin board for years just for the love of, look at what I can do. I can hook all this stuff up, make it talk, make it do all this. And then you always had somebody coming in going, how can we make money? If you're running a business, great. Tell me about it before. Tell me when I step in the door. Tell me when I log in that it's a business, because that way I'll leave, because that's not what I'm in it for. I'm in it for the information.
We've sowed the seeds of our own destruction, especially when the guys started wanting to charge money for bulletin boards. It was something that, you know, it was a hobby. It was my hobby. It was my computer. I was going to take that machine down. When I wanted to play with the computer, I was going to pull the plug on the modem. No question about it. And to expect somebody to pay for my hobby.
They weren't friendly anymore. They weren't people talking with people anymore. They were people talking with businesses. If you were to talk with somebody about something, you were talking to a hired mouthpiece. Basically, you're talking to people that have a policy and an agenda to speak, and that's what they're supposed to talk about, and it's not human anymore.
And they all wanted 15 or 20 bucks a month. You're going to rapidly run out of money. So I think the charge boards started the downfall of bulletin boarding.
And really, to be honest, I don't remember ever seeing a pay board that had anything unique on it. You know, like they had a gigantic selection of online games, or they had a gigantic selection of news feeds, or they had they had 20 lines or something like that.
There were people that were trying to charge to get some money back for it, but I wouldn't have paid to belong to BBS.
For the most part, I didn't really see the services as benefiting the user. I mean, the idea, or at least for me, was to have a good time and to learn something. And if someone else can have a good time and benefit from that knowledge, then everybody's getting, you know, payment out of that, if you want to call it that.
I never charged a dime to gain access to the bulletin board, and I always said that the day I have to charge for it is the day I'd pull the plug.
So it sounds like, at least from those folks' perspective, the pay BBSs represented a less friendly and a less hobby-oriented kind of environment. On the other hand, there were some folks who ran complex BBSs with complex hardware and had real operating costs, if not the computers and the modems, the recurring costs of the telephone lines. And in some cases, they would either take donations or some sort of a membership fee in order to offset those operating costs. Here's another audio clip from the BBS documentary where some folks explain that particular concept, recouping their costs.
There have been times when I've, you know, gone to the pawn shop on the behalf of SDF to pay for phone bills and things like that.
I did have a couple of users that, you know, would actually send 20 bucks every once in a while or something to help, just in general, to help keep it going.
A lot of bulletin board systems ran on donations. And even this one, when I booted it up the other day to take a look at it, it says, yes, please donate to the BBS, $1, $5.
The way I approached it was, for the first 5 years, I basically ran it as a freebie. Nobody, anybody that came on could not pay anything. From about 85, 86, and increasing from one line to four lines, and eventually up to 16 physical telephone lines, and having a three-figure phone bill, I decided, hey, we're going to have to put some kind of price tag on people having unlimited access.
So, you know, I guess I can see, if it was costing me three figures a month to run my hobby, my bulletin board system hobby, at some point I might be tempted to see if I could get the users to kick in a little bit. But in any event, there really were two sides to that. Also, there were scam-type ads for selling services to people who would be sysops back in the day. And some of these ads were get-rich-quick schemes. They'd make it seem like you could set up a BBS and immediately start charging tons of money for people and that you could make a fortune. It turns out, I mean, that really wasn't the case. There were some mega BBSs that made money and were successful, but they really had to focus on quality and offer premium services and, you know, be very diligent, have an attention to detail and a value add. I remember with the internet, I was in the dot-com arena. I worked for a dot-com company for several years, and there was always the concept of monetizing. And it sounds like this same sort of thing happened in the BBS realm, that at first it was a hobbyist endeavor, but then there was an effort to monetize various pieces of it, some successfully and ethically, and others it sounds like not so much. In some cases also, the content that was on the BBSs that you had to pay for had, well, let's just say questionable material. Now, there were BBS authors, you know, software companies that made money too and produced some real quality products. And there was even at least one magazine that I'm aware of called Boardwatch. And the people who talk about Boardwatch found it very cool, a whole magazine about essentially the BBS community. Now, skipping to the next episode here in the BBS documentary, there was an episode about FidoNet. This was a very successful endeavor to connect bulletin boards to each other. So imagine you're on a local BBS in California. I'm on a local BBS in New York. We both got a BBS. We're both happy. But how cool would it be if I could send an email to that BBS in California, and at night, the California BBS would relay it over to the New York BBS, where then the user in New York could pick it up. Kind of like the beginnings of a nascent sort of internet, in a sense. Although the internet has been around for a very long time, beginnings of it in the 60s. But for the microcomputer community, BBSs were the thing. And so connecting all these BBSs together with this FidoNet technology is very exciting. A fellow named Tom Jennings put this together. He'd originally written the Fido BBS. He worked for Phoenix Software doing BIOS programming and had a knack for doing programming with input-output. And about 1983, 1984, it sounds like somewhere in there, he wrote the Fido BBS, and not long after that, the idea evolved between Tom and some of the BBS sysops to connect these BBSs together. So Tom enhanced Fido with inter-BBS networking, and it became FidoNet. Here's an audio clip on that.
Tom and I used to talk on the phone frequently. I was talking to John Madill and got to thinking about it. He said, wouldn't it be neat if our boards could call each other up, exchange messages, or maybe exchange files?
There was other talk about this stuff at the time, and I don't recall it. But they were all very complicated schemes. Oh, we must get around this local call business. And I said, well, what does it cost? What does it cost? Just did the math. It just wasn't a whole lot of money. Basically, in 1 minute, you could move a couple of K of text or something. So the economics just went that bad. So did the first FidoNet.
we went through this transition where we went from being FIDO BBS to being FIDO Net.
Tom Jennings had logged in during the middle of the night somewhere along the way, and he'd uploaded a new FIDO, another program called FIDO Net, and a node list.
I'm actually launching two machines coast to coast connect, and error checking and resynchronization, all this stuff, and I was like, this is going to be a big machine. It was fun making a big autonomous machine.
And suddenly we had systems that could call each other up and talk to one another.
How it got spread out after that, because it was just amazing. We went from two to I don't know, it seems like 150 in less than 6 months or some such thing. And it just had a momentum of its own and mind of its own and just spread like wildfire.
It is interesting that FIDONet, you know, linking the systems together, building that BBS community. Just the whole thing is interesting stuff. I mean, there's four more episodes of that BBS documentary that I haven't given you any kind of Reader's Digest version on. And so it kind of strikes me that we ought to go for a third episode one of these days, maybe in a few weeks. If I give myself a little bit of slack time, maybe get myself a chance to chat with my friends who are sysops and also have a chat with Mike on that ham radio BBS stuff. And looks like I'll have to extend this out to a third episode. But, you know, don't necessarily sit on pins and needles for that. I'm not sure exactly when that'll come about. My best guess would be a few weeks from now. I'll bring you some more of this material because it's just really interesting. In any event, next week, here's the topic I'm thinking about. And some of you may not have ever heard of this, but those of you who have will probably recognize that I'm teetering on the edge of my first really controversial topic. The topic's called abandonware. And for those of you who just went, "Ooh, he's going to talk about abandonware. Oh, my. Everybody get your tomatoes ready." I have to decide if I want to get my first heated emails. Now, I'll let you know that I have a very balanced opinion on abandonware, but a lot of folks are extremely polarized on one side or the other of this issue. Won't talk about what it is right now, but you can Google it if you're interested in finding out more. I'm thinking about that for next week. We'll see how gutsy I am. In any event, thanks again for listening. It was fun putting this show together, as always. I just love being here with you folks. Again, the website, retrobits.libsyn.com. And please do send email about anything and everything, retrobits@gmail.com. We'll see you next week. I hope you have a fantastic week. And thanks again for listening. I'm rebooting for now. Bye-bye. Thank you.